Hey, welcome to the K Thompson Live Show. We're a little Hey, how you doing? Welcome to the K Thompson Live Show. We're a little bit late this evening because we're having a little trouble getting on Blog Talk with the service and stuff. Stepping up Blog Talk. We know that we have a couple of people on the line. Is one of them our host? And our guest, I believe, first our co-host, is that you, Mr. Wayne Gilman?
That's right. I am here. I was wondering what was going on.
Yeah, we were having a little technical difficulty. My name is Eric Payne. I got the lady of the hour. What's your name, lady?
I'm Karen Thompson Payne.
Okay, thank you. And we have a special guest with us today, Mr. Bernard Marsh, actor, dancer, Broadway performer, and I know you have a lot of other things. As an actor myself, I know that we have an author of this book called The Great White Way, White Lies. A lie can't live forever. I know how you feel, brother, because trying to break into the business there, all of us that are on the East Coast certainly try to do it in New York. So exactly what you're talking about. Your other book is called The Night Has a Thousand Eyes, and music is the soundtrack of my life. Welcome,
right.
Mr. Bernard Marsh. How are you? And I see you have a foreword by the legendary Lee Chamberlain in your book about Broadway. Welcome,
yes.
Sir.
Hello.
Yes.
How are you?
Yes. I'm fine. She's one of the founding members of... I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Bernard.
I said Lee Chamberlain was one of the founding members of the organization PARTS, Performers Against Racism on a Theatrical Stage, that we formed in the 1990s to fight discrimination on Broadway.
I see. And so let me just...
Very dear friend of mine.
Okay. Let me just give... Lee Chambers is a legendary black actress. And some people who aren't as familiar with the stage might have seen her in Uptown Saturday Night, I believe she was in?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And Let's Do It Again.
Paris, of TV.
And your background is, Bernard, is that you're a performer on Broadway. And what was, during the days that you were performing, can you give us a ballpark figure of kind of what era you might have been a part of?
Early 1990s to the late 1990s, before I was blackballed.
And you were blackballed because you...
Of my activism in the theater.
And you spoke up about how Broadway was so very, very white. Those of us that have tried to work on Broadway know that it's a very white environment, and they seem to regurgitate and renew the same old stories over and over and over again.
And over.
They beat them into the ground, the same ones they've been doing forever. They've been doing. And so I know you experience that quite often in your career. And as you say, your story is that you got active about it and you brought attention to it. So elaborate for that.
Well, it was in the early 1990s when I got into the show, a castmate of mine, Terry Burrell, introduced me to the civil rights portion of the union, and I started going to it's called CRE, I realized that, there were all these bylaws and contracts associated with diversity in the theater, but no one was paying attention to them. And as the years progressed and more shows began to come on Broadway and the diversity of black talent was less and less, it annoyed me. And I said, we got to do something about this. And I started speaking up at the membership meetings and found I was getting nowhere. And finally, with the help of a gentleman named Reuben Schaefer and Gina Ellis, we began to just question these things. And we wound up actually having to step outside of the union and form an ad hoc committee called PARTS, P-A-R-T-S, Performers Against Racism on the Theatrical Stage. And we did our own protesting, and we had to confront Cameron McIntosh, the Schuberts, Will Rogers Follies, Jerome Robbins, you know, and ask why there were no blacks in these shows, you know, and they kept on telling us things like, oh, there was no talent in the pool, or nobody showed up, and I said, nobody showed up. Wait a minute, there's records when you go, and especially when you're a union member, you have to sign a card that shows that you participated in this audition. And I said, well, here's the cards, and here's the people's names that went to these auditions, and you're telling me nobody black showed up? Wait a minute. Or there's no talent in the pool? Wait a second. The people that have gotten these jobs have taken classes from these same black dancers. They're in the show, and these black teachers are not. What are you, kidding me? And I just had to, you know, just confront them, and, you know, I just bare-knuckled right down to the, you know, to the ground, and I said, no, just don't work. You got to give me a better explanation than this.
Now, and, Bernard, you were instrumental in leading a lot of the black performers, you know, in protesting. And I'm so fascinated with the book because you mentioned such performers as Bessie Smith, Bill Bojangles, Robinson, Williamson Walker, Josephine Baker, Cicely Blake, Brick Fox, and some of Lottie McDaniels. I mean, these were people who were really known in early theater. You wanted to go for an interview, and you couldn't, and you didn't, even though we had some of the most talented black performers, you know, in the world. So how did you react to that? How did you react to that?
Right. But they were all in black shows, specifically black shows.
Yeah.
But then they brought in like 1960s, they brought in the non-discriminatory clauses, and also they had a book in the bylaws, a thing in the bylaws about non-traditional casting, which their Broadway producers signed on to and said they would make every effort to employ black actors, which they never upheld. All the advertisements in Backstage and all of the theatrical papers certainly gave specific descriptions of a white actor, 5'10", blue eyes, blonde hair, and never mentioned, other ethnicities are asked to come, you know. But it was just a word, you know, something they just said. But they never honored it, you know.
Yeah.
And when Les Miserables and the Phantom of the Opera came and, you know, these people, there were white kids in these shows that were in there for 4 and 5 years, retiring from these shows.
Yeah.
And you're telling me, black actors don't sing opera? Wait a minute. Let me go find. I'll go get you a couple of black opera teachers, and they'll tell you that there are plenty of them around, you know, and plenty of them have auditioned for these shows, and you've just overlooked them. You know, so I just held their feet to the fire until, they acquiesced and decided that, we can't beat them, so we've got to hire some.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Listen, I want you to go back and really see that what it was like during that time. It's not a fact, you know, you're talking about the Chitlin' Circuit. Now, you know, those of us who study history, we know, and we know that you know more than we know. So tell people what it was like, called the Chitlin' Circuit. Tell people what it was.
Well, my father worked on Chitlin' Circuit, and it was a circuit of black theaters and cabarets around the country that employed black performers. Everybody, Cab Calloway, Ethel Waters, Lena Horne, they all played, even though Lena Horne was from the Cotton Club, but the Cotton Club was on the black Chitlin' Circuit in the New York section. And that's how these actors made a living, going from state to state, city to city, working in these so-called black-only theaters and black-owned, you know, audience participation, you know. And then after the civil rights situation came in, black people, black performers went off into the white theaters, and then it dissipated the influence of the Chitlin' Circuit, which they should never have done, because it only employed a very few of them. But everyone said, well, I got to work. I want to go to Vegas, and I want to go to California. I want to work at the Brown Derby. But
was that possible?
Only one or two of us could have worked there.
Yeah.
You know, so that... watered down the effect. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
What about the New York theaters, like the Apollo Theater, and one in Washington? There was something in Washington, D.C. Small Paradise in New York, and Baby Grand in New York, and what is it? Rum Boogie in Chicago, and the Bronx Peacock in Houston.
Right.
Yeah. Well, you're mentioning all this in the book, and it's very exciting to read, you know. But go ahead.
My father worked in all those theaters, the Rumboogie and the Club Verona and the Baby Grand, the New York Baby Grand, and the Brooklyn Baby Grand. You know, that's how he made a living.
I see.
He went on the road in September, didn't come home till June, and then for the summer he worked all the theaters in the New York City area, especially
when
the Apollo.
When you say he worked them, what was his job? Was he a performer, a musician, what?
My father was a comedian, an MC, and a tap dancer.
Somewhat of a
singer. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
He had a voice like Louis Armstrong.
Wow.
So he did his own rendition of a particular songs, you know. But he made a living. He only worked when he came home from New York. He never worked from Monday to Thursday, and he worked Friday, Saturday, and Sunday in these various clubs around New York, you know, and until, you know, when I say we as a African-American audience decided that, now we can go downtown and go to the Paramount and Cherry Hill, that's where we're going to spend our money, opposed to, you know, keeping these places alive, even the jazz places, the Coronet, Blue Coronet in Brooklyn, Barber's My Way, they suffered immensely because the black audience wanted to go to the Copacabana and spend $300 to see Dean Martin and maybe Sammy Davis Jr. or maybe to Supremes, but wouldn't come to Town Hill or the Coronet to see Miles Davis or any Horace Silver, Max Roach, you know, only stalwarty proponents of jazz visited these clubs. And so they folded, you know, financially they couldn't sustain themselves.
Yeah. So now you mentioned movies that finally came about, you know, that were on Broadway, and black actors and actresses just did not want jobs as maids and butlers, but as real people in plays about us, like Curly, Raisin in the Sun, you know, the musical version, Bubbling Down Brown Sugar, Ain't You See Anything, and Hit Them All the Whiz. So how was that responded to once that stood open, you know, for black actors and actresses?
Well, at that time, Broadway was suffering. And the black musical was bringing in the money. So the white producers opened the theaters up to these productions. And when they recouped all the money they could possibly drain out of these productions, then the union itself and the members just turned on the performers, because they called, at that time, Broadway was, they gave it the nickname Black Broadway. And they said, well, all these black actors are working and all, and we're not getting any jobs and blah, 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 blah. But y'all been working for 300 years. Give somebody else a break. We got 5 years on Broadway. How much money are we going to make? You know, but that was a retaliation.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, at the time, I didn't realize that it was the union itself that I should be fighting, not so much the producers, because the unions were responsible for enforcing all of the agreements that were made with the Broadway producers.
Mm-hmm.
Besides, all the Broadway houses were owned by the producers, the Schuberts and the likes of them. So they had a monopoly like the movies. When they had the Lowe's and the RKO's, the government stepped in and said, no, this is a monopoly. You have to break this up. You can't be a movie producer and also own theaters. But they never did that on Broadway. The producers own the houses, so therefore they have the power to say what show comes in, what show moves out, and what shows we're going to rent to.
Yeah.
And so therefore, they closed down the productions of any substantial new black theaters.
And it really is, and what I've noticed over the years in working as well, like you're saying, it really is kind of a closed kind of community. And as you're talking about these producers, it is something that you notice that, you know, a certain number of producers control, like you said, what goes on Broadway. And now they have the corporations. And it's interesting what you said about the union not really enforcing some of those non-traditional casting things. You know, they would always talk about that.
Right.
But the times they were doing it, they would make a big spectacle out of it. You know, when they did Cat on the Hot Tin Roof with James Earl Jones back in the day playing Big Daddy and Stephen Collins.
That's one.
You know, but
that's,
they do it as
a
show.
Million.
Yeah, they do it.
Right.
And they do it as a way to say, we are doing it, but the rank and file, you know, it never really kind of trickles down to the average working.
And under a limited engagement.
Right.
And
exactly.
They don't encourage any kind of advertisement above 110th Street or in any of the black-owned or black-orientated newspapers. So black people, again, feel that, well, they don't want me downtown, or if I go downtown, I'm uppity. No, theater is a learning experience.
Exactly.
You know, and white people have been doing this for time immemorial. That's what Greek tragedy is about.
Mm-hmm.
Learning how to cope with life is not about waiting for the fat lady to sing. See, we think of theater as pure entertainment. We're waiting for the girls to sing the high note and say, "Oh my God!" You don't remember what the content of the play was. You know, you forget about the content of the play. The play was telling you something, but you're saying how well this girl, Jennifer Holliday, sang, and I'm telling you I'm not going. That's the climax of it.
Right.
What happened before that is what you need to know, how people manipulate other people to get what they want.
Yeah.
You know, and they, you know, and so it's like Raising the Sun. I just saw a production, amateur production of Raising the Sun. And a group of people were saying, oh, I didn't know this, I didn't know this. But Raising the Sun, you know, they were flabbergasted. I said, well, you know what? Yeah, it was a success, but the critics didn't stipulate what Lorraine Hansberry was telling you. She was telling you about Afrocentricity. She was telling you about the ability of, if you are black and you manage to get a certain amount of money, you have the right to move into a neighborhood or a building that you don't have to share, not just to share the basement with the bathroom with whom you're living with, but with your upstairs and downstairs neighbor. Y'all got to all use the same bathroom.
Right.
She was telling you all of this, and they were just saying, oh, what a one, they were just patting her on her head, saying they realized this was a milestone in theater, but don't let the black people know this.
Yeah,
go ahead.
No, I was going to say exactly what you're saying, and the message is being missed, is what happens a lot of time, as you know, in regional theater now. I found that as a performer working in regional theater, when these plays would come to down, you know, August Wilson came about and kind of revitalized a lot of the black dramas, that
mm-hmm.
genre. But when August Wilson shows would go to the regional stages across the country, the regional equity houses, well, what would happen a lot of the time is that a lot of these theaters, they have subscribers who buy tickets for the season. And
right.
So the subscribers, pick, as you know, they pick the shows that they want to go to, and maybe they'll go to see the August Wilson Tony Award-winning play. But what they don't do at these theaters is, as you said, Bernard, is they don't advertise in the black community to say, hey, this August Wilson play, this Tony Award-winning play, Fences, that was just on Broadway, is coming to Hartford, Connecticut, wherever, Philadelphia, or Walnut Street, or whatever. And so the black community within these areas, they don't know that these fantastic shows and that this play that they need to see by August Wilson, they don't know that it's at the theater. So what happens is that the community then really needs to see some of these brilliant works of art the most, doesn't get a chance to see it, and sometimes the houses aren't even full because the subscribers who've paid for a whole season maybe, they don't decide to show up for this black show. So
right.
The performers, a lot of times as performers, we're performing to a half full
empty,
house. Sometimes
empty
you might.
House, right.
And so this is what happens. And then as a result, I can remember performing in Baltimore during a play, and we were going across town, and there's a children's circuit play playing at a 1,900-seat theater. It's full, it's packed to the rims. They're charging the same prices that the legit equity house is charging, and
mm-hmm.
this buffoonery that's going on. But in
right.
that, there's been a certain amount of economic power. And if you look at Tyler Perry, he's a perfect example. But there were others before him, obviously, those of us that are familiar with that genre. But, you know, Tyler has developed that into a way to hire and support other black people in the industry. But the
what,
show,
one thing
the
about Tyler
show,
Perry, he's also taken to their understanding. Tyler Perry produces only shows in Georgia, which is a right-to-work state, where
mm-hmm.
he doesn't have to hire union performers. The only people who are contracted are the principals because they belong to SAG. Everyone
right.
else is just paid a straight fee. So you get
mm-hmm.
no royalties. So,
that's true.
Yes, Tyler Perry, I applaud his success, but I can't give him too many accolades because you're doing the same thing white folks do. You're beating
mm-hmm.
us out of what we deserve because you need to live in a 13-room house that you could only sleep in one bedroom a day or a night or a week. And you're going to the bank on me.
Mm-hmm.
You see, because everybody said, Tyler Perry, and what is he doing?
Yeah.
I'm wondering.
Wayne.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm just, you know, first of all, I want to say this is very fascinating. I'm really excited to hear all this. A lot of it I have been familiar with, and there's such a correlation between what this gentleman has gone through and a little bit of what our history has been, Kay, and myself in black broadcasting. And as it pertains to the issue of unions and the way that they segregate and they, you know, basically treat people, but, you know, you mentioned the Tyler Perry piece, and I was not unaware of the connection between the fact that, you know, it's a state that has that governance when it comes to employment. You know,
right
in New York State, you're an at-will state. You know, they can fire you at will. But That is very interesting, and you're right. It's commendable that he has hired a good number of us, but at the same time, I have a lot of things to say about my union, but thank God AFTRA is still paying my pension,
Yeah, you're one of the fortunate ones.
Yeah, exactly. And I realize that every day, but I also, go back to what you're saying. I grew up at the tail end of some of those places you talked about in Brooklyn, the Baby Grand. I didn't know what they were about. My parents, their roots were from the Caribbean, so I wasn't even exposed to stuff like that. But, It's interesting. I would love to see your book and read it, because that's something that would just complete that vacuum within me that I need to know. And you mentioned the Apollo Theater. The Schiffmans were also victims, even though they were Jews. They lost the Apollo because all of a sudden the Civil Rights Movement came about and everybody wanted to go downtown to see Aretha Franklin, the Gladys Knight and the Pips. And we have a lot to say in that too. I'm sorry. I mean, we have blood in our own hands, because instead of supporting and giving an opportunity to let one of these black institutions flourish, we lost it. And then when it was in black hands, I don't want to say anymore, because I've already been in court back and forth. My life is an open book. And I might even say on the tail of all this that I just found out today that my former employer, not the former employers, but the stations that Kay and I work for, have not been legally sold yet. A federal judge this past month just blocked the sale. So that's another chapter. But I'm just amazed to hear what some of the things you're saying. And I just don't know where I'd like to think, based on what you've gone through, things have gotten better, but I see it's the same old crap.
Before we go on, I want to tell people about Bernard's book. Now, the name of the book that we're reading now is The Great White Way, Great White Lies, as by Bernard Munch. And we're just touching on a small portion of this wonderful book. It's historical. And you have to get it, and you want to read about Broadway, you want to read about African-Americans on Broadway, off-Broadway, about the Apollo Theater, about a number of the different clubs going on. You're even talking about the Palladium, the Latin Club. So we're going to find out. Another book that you read, Bernard, this is the most recent one, The Night Has a Thousand Eyes. So here you say, music is the soundtrack of my life. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Well, that's about a young gentleman growing up in Brooklyn. Fiction. It's a book of fiction about a gentleman growing up in Brooklyn who goes through the trials and tribulations of reaching his goals and passions, and all the impasses that he has to go through to finally get to the point where he can pursue his life as he wishes it to happen, not as people instruct it to happen, or people are trying to force him to live this particular life. And this is about his struggles in living in Brownsville, being born in Bedford-Stuyvesant and being raised in Brownsville, and having all of the life experiences of a young man living in these communities who does have aspirations and passions, but has few outlets or few mentors to show him how to achieve this. So he has to find this out mainly on his own. And it's through his trials and tribulations he succeeds. And it's a noteworthy book for just people of any genre or any category of living to say, yeah, you have struggles, but you have to dig deep down inside yourself to reach your aspirations, and you just have to keep that focus and know that this, at one point, it's going to happen. You have to keep hope alive. There is something in that wording, in that caption, keep hope alive. And most times it's about you. It's you having, reaching for the passion that inspires or keeps the flame in you going. And this is a book about his life and the ins and outs of nightlife, gambling, prostitution, homosexuality, every possible facet of living
right,
that you could possibly. I'm sorry?
I said, all right, Iceberg.
I can't hear you.
I said, okay, Iceberg. I was referring to Iceberg Slim.
I mean, this is something that, you know, anyone can read, anybody can be inspired by it, you know. And it's a book that, you know, took me 3 years to write. And, of course, you know, a certified publisher wouldn't publish it. I'd have to, you know, I had to self-publish, as with The Great White Way, Great White Lies. But it's something that I felt I had to write, and I had to put it out there. So even if in the next 5 to 6 or 10 years somebody comes across and says, oh, gee, somebody wrote about this, huh? Well, it's here for you to read, you know.
Yeah, and you got it.
And with Greg,
you got it.
I'm sorry?
I'm saying you
I'm
got
sorry.
It done. I said you got it done. As anyone who knows, has tried to complete a script or a book or a piece of writing work, that is a tremendous and that you've written two books. And I'd like for us to get back into the trials and tribulations that present themselves in our culture of Broadway things and stuff like that. You know, I remember when I was first starting, like in the early 80s, graduated college and was there, would go through the trades and see the description, so-and-so, this, and sometimes they didn't have the blonde, blue eyes. Sometimes they just had All-American. So I'm figuring that's me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm all American, brought up in Jersey, Bruce Springsteen, the whole nine, you know, whatever.
Right.
But you go over there and you find out quickly, as you know, Bernard, that not our version of all American is what they're looking for. A little bit different kind of
it's a false perception that they want to keep, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, some of it falls, like I said. I don't particularly fault African-Americans wholeheartedly because, like I always say, he who has the gold makes the rules.
That's right.
And we don't, like you see, all of the most famous people today, the millionaires, black millionaires that we have, what do they own? They own record studios.
Mm-hmm.
And they make themselves producers, but they don't own the distribution rights to anything.
Right.
So you're still making pennies where the distributors are making dollars.
Right.
You know,
but also,
you don't want to reinvest in the neighborhood or the culture to produce anything that's worthy of longevity. Everyone wants a quick fix, you know, and we have decided that our culture is just transient.
Right. Well, it's like they say, our culture,
a lot of us
become successful, and we want to be crossover, mainstream, and leave our base market behind, which is ridiculous, because that's the market that brought some of those great plays, great films, you know, that I can remember in my childhood, the ones that were about
based on
black people, by and about and of black people, you know. And when you look at movies like Fucking Street, what Sidney and Harry Belafonte tried to do, and all of those films back in the day that that were true to us, you know, and going uptown to see plays and see black plays, you know, it's like they say about the black dollar only stays in our community for 15 minutes, where other dollars circulate in other communities 10, 12, 20 times over. And that is the problem that lies within our people, not just in art, but across the board. As Wayne and my mother said, it was media, and I'm quite sure in hard products as well. Unfortunately, our people, sometimes we feel what's other is better, you know, and being able
right.
to sit next to certain people, being able to sit next to certain people is going to make us better. And fortunately, hopefully, we're getting, our people are learning that that's not always the best thing just because you sit next to somebody. But we're going to have to wrap it up, Mr. Bernard Marsh.
Wow. It's time that we are going to have to wrap it up. But if we want to tell people about your book, because, you know, we want them, if you really want the story of black theater, of black Broadway, you have to get this book, The Great White Way, The Great White Way / A Great White Lie, that a lie can't live forever.
Right. And it will be out. I republish it on Amazon.com, and it will be the revised version will be out in about a week or two. And The Night Has a Thousand Eyes is on Amazon already, and you could order it from Amazon. Yeah.
That's great. So we're going to be talking to you another time because we need to talk to you some more, Bernard. So thank you.
Okay. I'm always free. All righty.
Thank you,
Bernard Marsh. We'll be talking to you soon. Take care.
All right, and God bless.
Thank you.
All righty.
Bye-bye. That was, talking to someone who's had those experiences and really reveal a lot of things that a lot of actors of color go through. And that's a really bold and brave man to do those things. And it really, you know, like you said, he got blackballed. But, you know, a lot of performers of color, they'll do whatever it takes. People sometimes get blinded so much and I disconnected Wayne by mistake. He seemed to, I don't know if you want to call back, Wayne, you should call back. But a lot of performers of color get blinded by having the opportunity. And sometimes they're willing to do whatever to have these opportunities. And, you know, it takes a lot of courage for someone to stand up and say, this is not right. Our people are not getting the type of same opportunities. You see it all the time. You see it in some of the roles that black men have to play in some of these movies. The buffoonery sometimes, unfortunately, putting on costumes and things that they might not want to wear or costumes just to kind of degrade the manhood of African-American men. And so Bernard is a very courageous man for writing this book and exposing this and putting his livelihood on the line because, you know, that's what you do when you step out and you speak truth to power. And so we really appreciate that. We want to have him back again because anytime I meet a fellow performer, fellow actor, I'm always interested in their story and what they went through. So we kind of covered the book a little bit and things like that, but I'd also like to talk to Bernard about some of his experiences in the many projects that he has worked on. So I
want to
get him to come back.
I want to get Wayne Gilman back on the line. Wayne, please call back in. We're waiting for your call there.
Anyway, we want to talk about some other stuff going on in the news today. There's some things that are happening. I guess within the last day or two, a lot of people out there might have discovered and heard about the Denny Hastert, the former Speaker of the House in Washington. This information has come out that he was paying someone all these years from an account to be quiet about a relationship that they had, and the notion is that he might have been, that the person might have been underage. It was when he was a high school teacher, a wrestler, and the person that he had this relationship with might have been underage. And it's alleged that he's been paying these people off all these years to keep quiet about this. And, you know, that's something that's really kind of it's eye-opening. It certainly is something that's kind of surprising that you have a guy that's the Speaker of the House that has been engaging in this, that's been engaging in this type of activity and certainly paying somebody off to keep quiet about a relationship that he had with obviously someone who might have been a minor underage at the time. And you know, he's been giving them hush money. And also, so it's a pretty interesting thing. Another quick thing I wanted to say, you know, one of my favorite movies is Opening. A movie based on one of my favorite TV shows, Entourage. Entourage, you know, if anybody's watched that movie or watched that TV series, it was a show about a guy who was a big star, and he brings his buddies with him along to Hollywood and makes them party, hires them, and kind of makes them just his entourage, really, to hang out with. But he gives each of them a job, a kind of a semi-job to pay them, to have them around. And it happens a lot of times in Hollywood when people become famous or successful. Of course, they want to be surrounded and hang out with their fellas, their boys, and with the females, with the girls. So, you know, I always enjoyed the show, I look forward to seeing the movie. It should be an interesting movie. Interesting thing about that, and I believe we have Mr. Gilman back on. How you doing, Mr. Wayne Gilman? Glad your call was dropped.
I think Blog Talk Radio was trying to sell me a message. I spoke too soon about the union and SAG.
Yeah, you got cut off.
I don't know what that was about.
About the union, which has long arms, man.
But
I just want to button that about, you know, if you're an Entourage fan, that movie's opening today. So, Wayne, we just got about another 6 minutes for the show, but, you know, you had mentioned something in us talking to Bernard about, you know, the similarities in the radio and things like that that Bernard was experiencing on Broadway in terms of people of color, the things we have to go through. And you want to elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, the thing is, I found them so fascinating. I mean, I'm ready to go out. I wish this book was available at Barnes & Noble's, you know, or something like that. But, I still wish to get a copy of it.
Yeah.
It's Amazon.com. You know. It's going to be on Friday, so everybody should go online.
Exactly. But I tell you, there was, you know, it's fascinating from the perspective that, you know, at one time, black radio was considered the chitling circuit for people of color who couldn't find work, you know, in the general market. And, you know, particularly stations outside of New York, the New York area. So, I mean, that station is beyond New Jersey. I'm talking Pennsylvania, south, north, east, west, doesn't matter. You know, those were the only institutions that many of us could actually, you know, carve our skills and scuffle and try to make a living from. And, of course, a little bit of the movie that we did, the Death of Black Radio, a number of years ago, talks about a little bit of that. But, you know, it is amazing that, you know, and I guess it shouldn't be so amazing because it really makes sense. If it's happening in that level of entertainment, clearly it's had to be happening on places like Broadway, television. You know, it doesn't matter who you are, where you are. These people have gone through tremendous struggles. You know, you think about, you know, the accomplishments many of our black female stars are making today, but you look at a Dorothy Dandridge or even Lena Horne and people who were just as accomplished. We just recently, within the last couple of years, lost Ruby Dee, but I'm certain she probably had a wealth of information about, you know, some of the problems that a lot of our stars have gone through. And the one thing Bernard Marsh pointed out, and I experienced that, you know, in my involvement with the union, that I felt the leadership in many instances did not work in the interest of the rank and file, you know. And it just goes, I know it's a money game, and very often, you know, I could never understand, you could do the same amount of work, and your your operation, you know, I'm not even going to mention call letters, but you could be the number one station in the market, and yet your skills were not compensated on the same level as stations that weren't even making anywhere near the amount of money that you're making. And then, as I said, and I say this unabashedly, some of us, when we get up there, in some cultures, they look back at that next generation. But we're too busy focused on pulling each other down like crabs in a barrel. And maybe that's my axe. I'm tired of that, you know. We've got to make changes now, you know. And I'd like to see some significant changes before, you know, I close my eyes and they throw dirt on me. I would hope that someday soon that things will, you know, the issues that we're still fighting over, the fact that there's violence in the street, you know, the fact that healthcare is a failure, you know. I mean, we should be talking about those things, you know.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
And I guess that I don't want to go overboard because I know we're running out of time, and it's just one of those things. But I'm just amazed, and I can't wait to get a copy of the book because he mentioned some things about my childhood in Brooklyn that I never knew, and I lived near the Baby Grand, and you know, so I'd like to find out more about his history.
Yeah, well, this book is absolutely fantastic. I'm telling you, it goes way back, you know, way back before the Apollo did even.
Right.
So, and then what is it? The Cotton Club and all that?
Well, you know,
he mentions all the stars and older people.
Unfortunately, you know, the great concept of integration really did a number in a lot of scenarios on our culture and our people. And from our educational system through, you know, black ownership of property and things like that. So, unfortunately, you know, they say the struggle continues. And, you know, we have to keep pushing each generation. Each generation has to continue to push forward despite the setbacks, despite the constant hate, despite some of our own even that aren't ready to be free. So we are come to the end for real this time. I want to once again thank the legendary newsman, our co-host, Mr. Wayne Gilman.
You're here.
Thank you. Yes, I'm just Wayne the Pain. I'm the third pain.
Well, thanks, Wayne. Thanks for calling in again, and thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's an honor and a pleasure to be with you all.
That's right, for being a member of the team. My name is Eric Payne. I am the son. In being on, talking on the microphone from my mom, I've done many things. And so, once again, thanks for calling to the K. Thompson Live Show. I'm the son, Eric Payne.
And I'm the mother of Eric and the friend of Wayne Gilman. No, we don't have a relationship, Wayne. I want people to know that.
Okay, all right. I was hoping one day something would happen.
All right. Hey, thanks again. Saga continues. Tune in next week, 8 to 9 p.m. on blogtalkradio.com/KThompsonLive.
And we're going to be talking about legal services.
Right.
So you can take advantage of
You can listen
of
to us every Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. live, or you can listen to any of the shows that are archived. Just go to our webpage on blogtalkradio.com. Thanks once again. We'll see you next week. And have a good week, everybody. Bye-bye now.
All right, that's time for a little fun. Let's do our version of What a Nerd Next. I know. Thank you.